For our next block, we have our lightning talks again. This one's going to be a tiny bit different because the monkey is going to keep track of the 6-minute timer. So I think it's just do not anger the monkey. And first up, actually, I encourage everyone to look up the bios of everyone here, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to do anything other than introduce them by name. First up is Michael.
Okay, so title of my, I'm Michael Wayland. I'm a PhD student at the Department of Statistics at Rice University down in Houston. Mostly do work on sort of brain stuff, neuroimaging, but once upon a time I worked in finance and still dabble. Title of my talk today is Convex Optimization for High-Dimensional Portfolio Construction. This is not a very financy talk or a very financy title. It's filled with a lot of statistics buzzwords, and there's a reason for that. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about the same thing that essentially everyone else today is talking about, this portfolio optimization question. This is really old. This dates from 1956, too, and basically everyone in this room has their own little personal variant of it. Many smarter, more interesting ones have been talked about today than what I'm going to talk about, but let's see. So this is the classic, very simple mean variance optimization problem, right? Just given some mu, given some sigma, you sort of do this risk-return trade-off. And there are better ways to do this, better measures of risk. How do you sort of get around normality? Or is standard deviation the right thing to do? These are all real difficult questions, but we're just going to take that problem as a given. So take these sample estimates. Again, naive, not great, but just work with them. Sort of put them in the problem and start, and then just do a little bit of math. This is just factorizing and dropping some constant terms, straightforward enough. But you notice something. You look at this, and if you're like me, you're a statistician, you say, okay, I'm trying to minimize some quadratic form, and you think, ah, I actually know this. I don't know finance, but I do know linear regression. I know, you know, statisticians don't know a lot about a lot of things. Like, as a field, we're actually very proactive about telling you how unconfident we are about things. But we do actually understand linear regression really, really well at this point in history. And we know how to do lots of tweaks and improvements on it. So if you start looking at portfolio construction in this vein, you can actually get sort of different statistical insights into the problem. So let's just take one example. Solving the Markowitz problem is typically uninteresting. You have real constraints, things that you have to do. You have investment mandates. You want to concentrate in things. You want to diversify in other things. Manage your transaction costs. All real problems, all things to address. Keep things short. We're just going to take a very simple cardinality constraint. I only want to invest in K assets of some sort, where K is some fixed number. So in theory, you just modify your optimization problem, very straightforward, add this cardinality constraint, and solve it. Unfortunately, this is NP-hard. And there are ways around this, very sort of approximate computing methods. Ross, Brian, Josh have all of this implemented for you. But I don't know. I'm lazy. I want an exact answer as opposed to a very good approximate answer, because it's nicer theoretically. So what can the statistical perspective get us? We're just changing this problem from saying find the portfolio with the best risk-return profile using at most K assets, changing this into statistics speak, finding the statistical model that fits my data best, again, using at most K variables now, K predictors. Again, it's impossible to solve exactly. Some really recent research says you can solve this with very advanced sort of mixed integer optimization for 1,000 assets on the scale of hours. It is an exact answer. This is actually really impressive theoretical work, but it's still really damn slow for not that big a portfolio. If you want to do 5,000, 10,000 names, it's never ever going to happen. So what do? We actually replace this with an easier problem. In statistics, this has been happening, a really trendy thing to do since 1996, something called the lasso. It's just take this L1 norm, this hard constraint, and sort of do the closest tractable version thereof. It's been hugely successful, just oodles and boodles and boodles of papers about this. How does this work? Like I said, we just change that count norm to something called an L1 norm, which is associated with this diamond here, and just stick sort of a penalty term on this optimization problem. Once again, so now we have two parameters, lambda, that sort of trades our risk return, and gamma, which says, okay, I'm willing to back off on being exactly optimal in the name of sparsity. So now you have two knobs to turn. How well does this do in practice? I'm not the first person to look at this problem. This is a few years old, noted by some folks at Princeton in the sort of wavelet world, and they've looked at this. Fitting this portfolio on sort of a representative data set, this is the Markowitz line, sort of how it does, this green line right here. This is if you constrain yourself to sort of only look at positive weights, a very typical adjustment. And this is what you get when you solve these problems. So not only are you getting these sort of cheaper portfolios to invest in with, you know, reduced transaction costs, you're actually getting really significant improvements in out-of-sample performance. And this is surprising. So why is this happening? There is some real deep statistical theory. Again, we actually do understand how regression works really well. First thing to notice is that this sort of shape right here, these sharp corners, give you a sparse portfolio. You're not forcing it, but because these are sort of low-dimensional faces of a high-dimensional polyhedron, you inherit sparsity sort of accidentally. You just bump into it. Next thing to be aware of is, even though asset returns are really correlated, even though if you try to think about this as a variable selection problem like a statistician, it's basically impossible. There's no way to really get a meaningful difference between, say, Coke and Pepsi. They act very similar. But you can still have a prediction-consistent problem. In this case, you're not finding what is necessarily the mathematically optimal portfolio, but you're finding something that has essentially the same risk-return profile. And that's pretty cool. This prediction consistency result is really, really weak. It almost relies on no assumptions whatsoever. And finally, and this one's actually pretty deep, why don't we overfit, right? This is the issue with the Markowitz portfolio. If you just fit your data, you're really going to sort of double down on just random noise and overfit your data. Well, it turns out that there's this wonderful knife-edge balance in lasso theory that says because of the shrinkage component, because of the bias that's automatically induced, that exactly sort of counterbalances the search procedure, right? So even if I'm, you know, selecting a 10-asset portfolio out of a stock universe of 10,000, it has exactly the same amount of overfitting as if I had started with those 10 assets in the first place. So if you want to go further, statisticians have done a lot more structured sparsity. You can control groups or non-overlapping groups, all sorts of things. There's a lot of work to be done here, references on all of it. The theory, deeper simulations on all this is showing up on archive soon. Full disclosure, this is academic soon, which is more on the scale of months than days, but it is soon. And thanks to everybody who funds my life.
And next up is Lucas.
Hi. I'm going to talk today about the impact of parameter estimation on risk parity portfolios. And let's start with an example. When you look at the performance of a trading model or a strategy portfolio, we typically look first at an equity curve. In this example, we have the three risk parity portfolios: inverse volatility, minimum variance, maximum diversified portfolio, applied to the S&P 500 stocks, and we look at the out-of-sample performance. What we tend to forget at that point is that this is only one out of several possible outcomes. Outcomes can be different because either we estimate different parameters in sample or because the market gives us different performance out of sample. So in this slide, I added 50 lines, which correspond to 50 possible outcomes when parameters are estimated differently on a bootstrapped calibration sample. So what I'm going to do is measure the sensitivity to parameter estimation by looking at the dispersion of the out-of-sample performance of those portfolios when they're bootstrapped, meaning when they're calibrated with a bootstrapped version of the calibration period. This fits to an observation by Harvey and Liu, who said that financial variables are intrinsically linked in complicated ways. And because they're linked in complicated ways, we don't want to make any distributional assumptions, and we want to maintain their dependence information, including nonlinear and higher order moment dependence. Also, we're going to use a block bootstrapped with month-long blocks in order to maintain serial correlation. So let me get a bit into details on this experiment. You see on the top a bunch of colored blocks. Those represent monthly blocks of returns. And what we do to create one of the bootstrap paths, we first take the first n, in this example n is 10 blocks, randomly draw 10 elements from it, and then recycle this random sequence over the whole data set. So if you had the first month's return in our data set, we're also going to have the 11th. If the second is missing, the 12th is missing, and if you have two times return number 3, we have two times return number 13 as well. Now we're going to estimate portfolios in a rolling window over this bootstrap sample, and those rolling windows will be identical in their overlapping portions, and they all have going to have exactly 10 elements. We then estimate those portfolios and apply them out of sample from the end of one calibration period to the end of the following calibration period. This experiment is performed in two asset universes, the historical index member of the S&P 500 and the data set of 42 global futures. This data set is more heterogeneous and therefore more difficult for a portfolio strategy to work in. So let's look at some results. We see results reported on the left side for the portfolio of S&P 500 stocks and on the right side for the global futures. On the top row, you'll see a constant target volatility, and on the bottom row, we constrain to full investment. What you see here is the solid line representing the median outcome and the shaded area representing 80% of the outcomes based on bootstrap strategies between the 10th and the 90th percentile. Since this is a lightning talk, let me actually look at one single risk-return measure of the Sharpe ratio over the entire period, and let me plot here the distribution of Sharpe ratios that we get with this 50 by calibrating portfolios to these 50 bootstrapped samples. So we see that portfolios perform better or less, so the mode or the average of those distributions is higher or lower, and also for different portfolios you get a different sensibility to parameter estimation that we observe here by the width of the distribution. If you look at the top performing portfolio in the S&P 500 stocks in the period studied, it's the maximum diversified portfolio. It's also the second best portfolio in the global futures. We can see that this is a portfolio that uses the covariance information, so quite a lot of parameters to estimate, really. It maximizes the weighted, the diversification ratio, which is the weighted average of single asset performance divided by, of single asset volatility divided by portfolio volatility. So actually it does pay off to use a strategy that has a larger amount of parameters to estimate, and that also, of course, increases the sensitivity to parameter estimation. So that brings me to a new question on my personal agenda, how to mitigate the impact of parameter estimation. If you have any experience with that, come and talk to me. As a last thing, thanks for all for the offers of these great packages. It's absolutely great to work in R, where code is already available, reduces time to implementation, and also reduces the number of errors. Thanks.
So, hello. I'm Ilya. I'm sure most of you know me. I am a front office dev and energy quant at BP right now. My work. That's my blog, that's my email, you know where to find it. This is called Global Adaptive Asset Allocation, which is actually an ETF that Meb Faber said he is launching between the time I completed this presentation and today, and the possible end of momentum, and you will see why. So we're going to take the 13 assets from Meb Faber's Global Adaptive Asset Allocation book. So there's the list of ETFs. And the methodology you can find in Resolve Asset Management's Adaptive Asset Allocation book. And essentially, in a nutshell, it's some combination of momentum with the risk management. So they advocate some sort of mean variance optimization, and I'll present several risk management methodologies. So when we're talking about the statistical significance of momentum, then we have positive betas and extreme statistical significance for the sample, which was 2003 to 2009. And taking the top six assets against an equal weight of all 13, we're seeing a generally positive expectation, and so you could see that there. And so taking the Monte Carlo results, that since I'm going with the top six, that I take six random assets every month and do 1,000 different permutations and compare them. So as you can see on the left, the momentum, the returns are wildly better than the Monte Carlo. The volatility is comparable, and the Sharpe ratio is definitely out to the right tail. So which lookbacks mattered? So on the momentum side, you can see that the 1, 2, and 7 month lookbacks were not so great. 1 and 2, we know that momentum isn't all that great. 7 I found a bit surprising. Anyhow, I wound up going with the 3, 6, 9, and 12 month momentums for a quarterly. For the look back on the risk management, that you can see on the right, that essentially the look back really didn't matter as compared to the momentum look backs. So the three risk management algorithms were inverse sample variance, or volatility rather, and the normalized 1.25 minus max percentage contribution to component expected shortfall, and the David Verity maximum decorrelation algorithm. So you could find that on the CSS analytics site. And so the conclusion is, in this case, that momentum lookbacks matter, and which risk management schemes matter? Well, anything except equal weight is good. They all had comparable performances. So the in-sample backtest looks fantastic, with an annualized Sharpe of 1.88. And so when I ran it through, ran all my permutations through Marcos Lopez de Prado's deflated Sharpe ratio algorithm, I get a highly significant 0.0006 p-value. So there's definitely a strategy here. It's not just an overfit piece of junk. So that's highly statistically significant evidence. But out of sample, the strategy really deteriorates. So the in-sample statistics, I had a 14.4% annualized return, 766 vol, and a 188 sharp. Out of sample, it just plummets, 559 Kager, 794 vol, and 0.7 sharp. So basically got cut by two-thirds. So there are three lines here on the right picture. The blue one is separating in-sample from out-of-sample. The red one is when Meb Faber actually published his global asset allocation ebook. And so after that, it takes its historically largest drawdown ever. And then the green line, which isn't very visible, is at the trough of that first part of that W, which is when adaptive asset allocation was published by Resolve Asset Management. So basically, as you can see, that momentum was doing really well until 2015, when it really didn't do well. And out of sample from 2010 onwards just seems that either the paradigm shifted or God knows what else, but the performance out of sample is not all that good compared to the in sample. And thank you. You know where to find me. Those interested in my skills can reach out to me. And just want to give you a heads up about Meb Faber's upcoming ETF, apparently, that took me a bit by surprise, but there you go.
And our next speaker is Vyacheslav, which I will point out one additional fact, that he came all the way here from Siberia, and he's come here more than once. So.
Hello, everybody. Today I will speak about a strategy which I tried to develop at previous time. So it's about dividends. And the idea was, what would be to make strategy which, when we buy stocks before one day, before minus one day before ex-dividend date and sell in ex-dividend date. So at this situation, we bring dividends from the stock, but there is some empirical fact that at such situations, there is night gap. And so in most cases, this gap is smaller than the dividend size. So such situations was named in science as ex-dividend date anomaly. And there is few explanations of such situations. First, this is tax effect when investors should pay tax for the government for the bringing dividends. And the next explanations, this is microstructure effects, and it's related with small liquidity at the first minutes of the trading day. And so at the next step, I try to analyze strategy when we buy the dividends. So the data was from Finance Yahoo, and we use QuantMod packages, and also we are trying to use data from Bloomberg. Thank you, Dirk, for the Bloomberg package in R. So we have universe of 2,000 US equity with periodicity of dividends quarterly and yearly. And the important fact is that we should use adjusted dividends for adjusted prices or non-adjusted dividends for non-adjusted prices, because the result can be changed when we don't use correct data. So what we find? We find, first of all, we're trying to chart a scatter plot with dividend yield and gap return. So this is night gap, and we calculated it's like open of the ex-dividend date divided by close of ex-dividend minus one. And so what we find? We find that there is negative correlation between gap size and dividend yield, and also the dividend, it's like more than gap size. So, but when we exclude tax from the dividends, we give the zero in the result. So when we not see to the tax, so if we think that tax is zero for us, so the such strategy would be great with Sharpe ratio equal to 1.6. But what if our tax would be 10%? So the picture is changed. So with these situations, it's not such great strategy, as you can see, and the Sharpe near the zero. But idea is to, what if we want to create model which can predict which situation is profit for us and which situation is in which situation we have loss. So we create logic regressions with some factors which related with, for example, relative dividend size or, for example, volatility. And so what we have now, so the strategy with Sharpe equal to 2, but what's the problem in such strategies that with big volumes, for example, under management. We can't execute, for example, at the price of open price, or for example, at first, for example, 5 or 10 minutes. And so the profitability of such strategy is decreasing with closing price, with increasing of time to the closing price. So if you have some questions, I can answer this after my presentation. So thank you.
Hello everyone. I'm Nabil Bouamara, PhD student at the KU Leuven. And today I want to make you familiar with regulated liquid alternatives and fund selection using reliable ranking criteria. I have to admit that this is still ongoing research in cooperation with the Luxembourg Investment Fund. So the following minutes will be a combination of work in progress and experience in professional spheres. Investment management has long been a strong suit of Europe's financial services industry. Switzerland and London have built up thriving private banking and alternative investment industries, and France has been home to some of the world's largest asset managers. Today, amid new regulation, the face of Europe's asset management segment is changing. Investors are anxious to avoid repeating disasters and poorly informed investments. So in spite of the new challenges, we're not necessarily seeing positions slip. There's a market segment which is consolidating a position as a leading center for transparent and tightly regulated funds. Underlying this concept is the UCITS directive, which was set up to harmonize a regulatory regime across the European market and establish a minimum level investor protection. In short, UCITS compliant funds meet strict liquidity, transparency, and risk requirements. Although it was set up for mutual funds, it has been seized on by hedge funds to offer absolute return. So the fund structure also allows access to sophisticated active management strategies, long short, momentum trading using managed futures, in a UCITS wrapper. And over the last few years, alternative UCITS have been growing rapidly, both in AUM and in number of funds, and assets alone have quadrupled since 2009. Aside from being a standalone product, the structure also allows access to multiple underlying managers using an umbrella structure. For us, it's important to build portfolios, so we take into account the adaptive market hypothesis. So we expect a set of outperforming funds to vary over time. For today, we'll focus on the performance of a particular style, the equity hedge long short funds. We invest in liquid instruments with, in most cases, daily pricing. And a few empirical studies that are available, they focus on performance on an aggregate level. So, but we believe that it's a diverse landscape. There will always be excellent performers and laggards in any index construct. So our goal today is to find those talented funds. A central problem in fund selection is the risk-adjusted performance of funds. Several studies have questioned the skill of the hedge fund manager, indicating that their return might be driven by passive systemic factors. And equivalently, we will do the same. We will use factor modeling to isolate manager-specific component from common factor performance. And the most common way to do this is to regress fund returns on a series of risk factors, such as the equity risk factors by Pham and French Corard, and the hedge fund risk factors put forward by Fung and Xie to proxy dynamic returns. And then we build on the hypothesis set in Blitz that the performance of momentum strategies can be improved by the use of residual return. Let's take a step back. If the objective is to invest in portfolios, you want to detect those funds that outperform their peers. So it's more about relative performance in a constrained universe. And the most common way to do this is to compute a performance measure, in this case the alpha, and then rank the funds and use percentiles to classify outperformance. Without regard to the possibility that funds may show similar performance, the method may be prone to false discoveries. So to address this problem, we use the peer performance evaluation framework by David Ardia and Chris Bout to obtain estimates that are robust to false positives. The figure we see is a so-called screening plot. It's introduced in the same paper, and it shows us the peer performance ratio distribution across funds. So on the left, we show the alpha, rank it, sorted in buckets. On the right, for the corresponding buckets, we show the estimated out, equal, and underperformance. So the underperformance is the percentage composition of the peer universe that underperforms our focal fund. So what do we see? We see that the alpha and peer performance ratios are positively but non-linearly dependent. And we see a lot of heterogeneity, a lot of equal performance in alpha differentials, the light gray zone. So what do we take away from this? It's that outperformance is rare, but it does exist. So is there added value in complexity and model-based estimation? So in summary, we use the portfolio sort to that adopts a ranking criterion of reliable signal of superior relative ability. And we integrate the use of risk premia in a bottom-up selection of funds. So with all these ideas, we show that the allocation improves after correction for false discoveries as compared to the traditional use of rolling averages, which had an alpha indistinguishable from zero. Our economic performance, the economic value, is seen in the snail trail, which plots return differences and risk differences versus the benchmark, which is the gray dot. And it's a standard HFRU equity hedge style index. And where you want to be is in the second quadrant, where the return is higher, risk is lower, happy land, as you will. And for the correction after false discoveries, we are able to do just that. So we're able to detect skilled funds over time and capture their superior alpha, since, as you remember, UCITS funds have a daily liquidity and a biweekly redemption. So it's an investable strategy. So altogether, the empirical results support our view that factor spaces, reliable ranking criteria, can be useful in fund-to-fund allocation. And I really want to underline that this is not a case about the blue line is above the red line syndrome, as we see a lot in factor investing. It's more about informativeness and estimation error of the ranking criterion. Thank you.